This podcast is part of the Deluxe Edition Network. To find other great shows on the network, head over to deluxeeditionnetwork.com. That's deluxeeditionnetwork.com.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Deluxe Edition. I am your host, Casey Shearer. Joining me, as always, the bad stripper, L. Ray Sexton.
How we doing, Casey?
Good, buddy. How are you?
We're having another fantastic Sunday.
Yeah, this was another great episode, man. Marcy Warhaft, we just had on. She is the author of The Good Stripper, a soccer mom's memoir of lies, loss, and lap dances. And what an interesting person.
Yeah, and eventually I'm going to read the book, but I know you already read the book, so you got a little more insight into her than I do.
Yeah, this is Marcy. You know, I started the interview off with, it's amazing to see that you always have a smile on your face. And obviously, you know, as happy as we are on this podcast, we don't always have a smile on your face. But the shit that she's been through and the stuff that she posts on her social media, like the like Ray mentioned, and she's like does a lot of dancing videos on her Instagram and stuff. She always has a positive attitude, and some of the stuff that you're going to hear in this interview is like, holy shit, like how do you maintain that positive attitude like throughout your life? Because she's been through a lot of stuff, and we highly recommend this book. Go check it out. And we'll get right into the interview right after this quick house cleaning. What do you say, Ray?
Sounds good.
All right. So we are a part of the Deluxe Edition Network. You can find all the other great shows over at deluxeeditionnetwork.com. And the podcasts of the month, this month, are Drink O'Clock Podcast, who also you can catch Marcy on with Rob Valencias. She was on the Drink O'Clock Podcast with him. Quad Pro Quo and the Steve and Crypto Show. You can find those all over at deluxeeditionnetwork.com. They're all great shows. Rob is more of an interview show. Steve and Crypto, they do a bunch of interviews too with horror, mostly horror people. And then Quad Pro Quo is they do movie reviews. So go check them out. If you'd like to check any of our previous shows out, go over to deluxeedition.show. Go and check out. I've been doing a lot of reels over, or shorts as they call them, on Instagram. And then what kind of stuff are you doing over there, Ray, on Instagram?
I do memes, birthday posts for celebrities, and movie premieres from when they came out. You know, like yeah. If you want to know when, like, Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom came out, I'm your guy. That's what I do over there.
Yeah, there's a lot of cool stuff over on Instagram. Instagram at Deluxe Edition Pod with one E. And let's see, what else we got? Come check us out on Facebook, Deluxe Edition Pod. If you'd like to support the show, you can go over to patreon.com/deluxeeditionpod. And what's that special we're running over there on Patreon, Ray?
We are running the $5 tier for $1. That is a big slash. That was five fingers. Now it's just one finger. And it's not even my favorite finger. I'm just going to give you this finger. It's one. Yeah. $1.
Yes, come and on, we do. We
help us out.
Yes, and we must actually give a shout out. We do have someone has signed up. I don't know their full name because they've only signed up by their initials. But it's TLS. So thank you, TLS. We appreciate your support. Tell your friends. If you want to buy a t-shirt, go over to whatamaneuver.net/collection/deluxeedition. Or if you don't want to pay the big bucks on the good t-shirts, head over to Ray's site.
Yeah, I got the bootleg merch. You need a tote bag. You need whatever you need. I got it. I got magnets, stickers. I noticed somebody just bought the Evel Knievel jumping over the kids t-shirt over there the other day.
Nice.
So, yeah. I don't know if they realize that's a photo edit, because originally I was a little kid on a bike, but I put Evel Knievel in there. That's some quality photo editing right there, Casey. But yeah, you can get coffee mugs, t-shirts, tank tops. Once again, we're coming up on summer. You know, all your lady friends are going to want the white extra, extra small deluxe edition tank top. Going to look really good at the pool. I'm telling you.
There might even be, I think there might be some thongs on there as well.
If there's not, I'll get on it. Because,
all right.
I mean, we got the onesies for babies. They could probably squeeze their asses into those. Or the tote bag. I don't give a shit. They can come feet hole in the bottom.
Wear the tote bag. All right. That's. I think that's it. I think that's all the plugs. Yeah. Yeah, but definitely check out this book after you listen to the interview, The Good Stripper, A Soccer Mom's Memoir of Lies, Loss, and Lap Dances by Marcy Warhaft. And here's our conversation with Marcy. Hope you enjoy.
Here she is.
Hey, Marcy.
Hello. How are you guys?
Good. How,
good. How are you?
I'm all right. I'm all right.
Good. How's Canada treating you?
You know, the whole world's a bit of a dumpster fire right now, but the Canada's okay. It's all right. Weather's weird. It's like 17 and warm one day and then snow and then whatever, but.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I saw your picture today. It looked like it was snowing up there.
Oh
today.
My god, it's just the wind was insane. Where are you guys?
I'm in Cleveland.
Ah.
Yeah, and I'm in Tallahassee, Florida.
So yeah,
how's that? Was,
it's always nice where Casey is. Thursday it was 65 here, and then Friday was 15 and snowing.
And right.
Now we're back up into the 30s. Looking at some nice 40s for tomorrow.
It's insane. Nice to meet you guys.
Yeah, we saw the, before you moved the camera over there, we saw the title of your book there, the book in the background. That's what we're going to talk about. That's you are the author of The Good Stripper, A Soccer Mom's Memoir of Lies, Loss, and Lap Dances.
That's right.
And after reading this, Marcy, I don't know how you constantly have a smile on your face. You've been through so much shit.
Well, I don't constantly have a smile on my face. It's just I'm not a sociopath, so I do definitely have my moments. I just try not to drown in it. But I'm glad. Thank you for reading it. I guess you know me really well right now.
Yeah, very well. Yeah, well, actually, I always say that I read the book, but I listened. I'm an audiobook guy, so I listen to it.
Same thing.
Yeah. So let's start with that. Let's start with the audiobook. So why did you decide to keep the typos in there?
I'm flawed. So, you know, nothing's perfect. So you just kind of go. I'm the most like imperfect, low maintenance, easygoing person. And I just sort of wanted it out there. And I don't worry about that stuff.
Yeah. No, I like that. I like how like you're reading along and you're like, oh, why does it say that? That's not right. And then you like kind of fix it.
Yeah, because you know what it is? It's, I write like I speak, and that's how I kind of wanted it. I'm no Shakespeare, you know, and so it's the same thing with the audiobook. I just want it to be where I'm just talking to you. I didn't want it to sound scripted. And if I could do it again, I'd probably be a little bit more polished. I'm also be more comfortable with the material now. I did it kind of early on, and I was still getting comfortable with what I wrote. Writing it is one thing, but saying stuff out loud, you'd be surprised. I was kind of like, oh, God, I said that? I wrote that? That's... So it was a bit challenging, but you just got to go with it.
So in your book, you talk about like, you know, some of the things that you hid for a long time. And then, you know, you writing a book that there's no more hiding. So like what was the decision to finally, you know, open up and write this?
For years, I'd had a couple of friends who knew parts of my story. Nobody knew all of my story. But the parts that they knew, they kept trying to get me to write a book because they felt that, like you said, I'd been through a lot and I'd survived a lot. And they felt that people would be able to, some things would resonate with them. They could connect with certain things and maybe seeing me come out of it would help them. But problem was, I wasn't at a place yet where I saw that. So I say all the time, I was seeing my struggle. I wasn't really seeing the triumph of it yet. You know, I always say that I judged myself on how I survived instead of being proud of myself for the fact that I survived. And so I wasn't ready yet. I was still carrying a lot of shame. And then I was turning 50, actually. And I'd gotten to a point where I'd left my marriage for a few years. I was in a different place with myself. And I was feeling like, what am I waiting for? I felt like I was living sort of has me, because I would meet people and go, what do I tell them? Should I tell them about my past? How much should I tell them? And what are they going to think? And I hated that. And I hated that I had older kids, and I thought, I still had fear, even though the crazy stuff I'd done was decades earlier, I was still afraid that the truth would come out, and what would they think, and how would it impact them? And going through life with that kind of fear and guilt and shame, it's not fun. And I had seen through my family and things in my past that life can be very short. And I didn't want to get to the end of it and not having sort of become comfortable with me being fully me. And I kind of thought that whole cliche of if not now, then when? And I was just at a point where I was ready to tell the truth. And I decided if I was going to write the book, I was going to write it. You know, I wasn't going to hold back. I wasn't going to keep the stuff that made me look bad secretive. Like it was going to be all out there. And it was just time. It's kind of like, I think if you look at a scar, if you have a scar in your body, you know, you can look at the scar and see the pain, or you can see the healing. And I spent so much time just seeing the pain that caused the scar instead of seeing it as healing. And now I own my story and it's empowering, and it was just ready. It was time to share it. So I did. And it was terrifying, but also really, really liberating.
Yeah. Was it like when you finally, like, you know, when it was available to the public, was it like a weight was lifted off of you?
No, I would say that writing it was great, because there were things that I always tell people, even if you don't want to share with people, write your story, because writing it out gets it out of your head and you get to see it more clearly. So I saw certain things when I was writing it, and I went, oh, okay, that's why I did that, or that's why I felt that way. And I could understand myself better. And that was really liberating. Releasing it was kind of like, you know, what's going to happen? Because then you realize, okay, it's out there, which is cool. Oh, but people are going to read it. Like that's crazy. But what was the best part of it was once it was out, and once people were reading it and people were connecting with me, people I knew, people I'd known when I was 7 at camp, people I didn't know from all over the world. And when they were connecting with me in a positive way, that was the best part. Because I really did not know. I honestly did not know if I was going to lose everyone. But I was ready. I was ready for whatever happened. I just had to tell it. It's a weird thing. Like, I just didn't want to die with my story inside me, which really sounds melodramatic when I say it, but that's how I felt.
No, that's not. I mean, everybody's got a story to tell. And so, like, how do you go about, like, now, like, when you meet people, do you open up? Do you, like, tell them, like, I have a book. If you want to know my story, just read this, or... You know, we all have that fear. Like, what should we tell this person? Yeah,
I know.
Because, like, I've done some weird shit. You know,
I know. And that's true. How much do you tell? How much? It's a weird thing when people say, "What do you do?" If I say I'm a writer, and they say, "Oh, what's the name of your book?" That's always I should be able to just say it, but you know, because you read it, it's a bit deceiving, because it's not a stripper's story. You know, I've had people say, I've had people who hadn't read the book invite me on their podcast and want to hear about life as a stripper. I'm like, you got the wrong person. I did it briefly several years ago. It's a small part of a bigger story. So when I tell the title, The Good Stripper, everyone's like, oh, you know, and I'm like, yeah, I mean, it's salacious and there's stuff in there, but it's more than that. So that's kind of, because it, you know, hey, how are you? I'm a good stripper. You know, it's kind of, it really puts it out there right away, and kind of a, but then again, I own who I am. So, but I'm careful about how much I tell, but it doesn't look, social media, it takes 2 seconds to find out about somebody. Right. So what's the point of even trying to hide, but it's an interesting process. It does go through my head as soon as I'm meeting somebody.
So you mentioned your sons, and you talk about your sons in the book. Do you know if they have read it, or if they, do they know the story?
So they haven't read it. I don't think they're going to read it. Maybe they'll read it when they're older, like much older, like when they're my age. And I think if they did read it much later, they would probably gain new insight to me. They would understand me a little bit more, because you don't really we don't know our parents, you know, that well. We don't know. We know what they show us, kind of thing. But I have to say that they were amazing from the get-go because they knew parts of my story, but they didn't. They didn't know that, again, the kind of secretive stuff, the salacious stuff. They didn't know the sex stuff and the dancing stuff. They didn't know that. And when I first told them, first I just told them the title of the book. I showed them the cover. That's how I showed them. That's what. And they were both amazing. Like they were just like, oh, great cover. Like they. And one of them wanted to know more. The other one didn't really care. And in the best way, both of them were like, hey, like they didn't know what was going on when they were little because I was there all the time. And I say that in the book. That's one thing. I didn't sleep because I was there. Whatever the craziness I did when they were sleeping, you know, or when they were at school. So I made sure I was there. So they, it's not like they were like, oh, that's why you weren't around. They're like, when did you, how would so they, and they've said to me, that they are in my corner and that I have their support 100%. And that really, I mean, it doesn't get any better than that.
Yeah, no, that's awesome. So yeah, you mentioned like the stripper part, that is only just a very short part of your story. So like, why did you choose that title? Just like as a,
you know? No, because the dancing part of it was only a few months, but that was part of a double life that lasted several years. So that was the swinging, that was the promiscuity, that was me really living this double life of being this, trying to be the perfect mom and kind of housewife, I say during the day and then kind of the vixen at night, but it wasn't, it was during the day too, you know, when the kids were in school or whatever. So it was that specific part of it, the dancing, was only a few months, but again, it was part of this double life that lasted years. And I think it's, The thing about the dancing is it's significant. You know, it's something doesn't have to go on for years and years and years for it to have an impact on your life. And so for me, the fact that I would go 48 hours without sleeping so that I could be with my kids all day, put them into bed at night, go to the club, dance, come back at 4 o'clock in the morning, go to the gym to keep my body up, get home, take a shower, be up with the kids again. The fact that I was putting myself out there trying to be secretive, but meanwhile, anybody can see me and have this fear of somebody from school is going to find out. One of the teachers is going to find out. That was it was a huge part of my life. So the fact that that specific part didn't go on that long, it still had such an impact. To this day, I still, there'll be people who will contact me or, and I wonder, was it from that? You know, it's significant. And so that's why it made sense.
Yeah. Wow. So before this book, like you, the only thing that you really talk about writing is the petition about your teacher in the very like beginning of the book. So like, what was the process like for writing this? Like, did you have any help or like, how did you go about publishing it?
Well, I never took a writing course. I didn't go to university, but I always liked writing. And so I did write for magazines, kind of freelance and write blog. And because I started out back in probably 2007, I became an expert in body image and self-esteem. And I did that through, I would just start writing blogs and then got picked up by Huffington Post and blogged for them. And then again, started freelancing for different magazines and newspapers. So I did write like that. And I did publish a small book for parents called The Body Image Survival Guide for Parents. So I wrote, but it wasn't professionally, but I did write. And then when it came to this, honestly, I did not know how to write a book. I didn't know. And I just kind of started writing. I had a friend who was an agent, and he sort of gave me some tips. And I just tried it. And I swear, I would send it to a friend of mine who used to edit. And I'd say, is this how it works? Is this how a book works? Like, I really didn't know. And I just kind of, I just kept doing it. And then a friend of mine introduced me to a publisher, and I sent some stuff, and they liked the concept of it. They liked the story. And they said to send them a book proposal, which was about 42 pages long. And I sent that, and they liked it. And it was just like, keep writing and keep sending it. And it just kind of came together. It was tough because it didn't take long. I think writing the entire thing before I sent it to the publisher took about 7 months. And, that's fast, but it was, that's all I did. I was in my basement, and that's all I did. But I really had to open up every scar that had healed, about every trauma I had been through, because I really wanted you to feel, as the reader, what I was feeling. And that was hard. Like, that's a tough thing to live in some of those days. I share sometimes that there were a couple of chapters where I started writing at night and I just wrote through until the next morning because I did not want to live in that day or that week for more than a few hours because it was really hard to put myself back there. But it was important for me to be as raw and open and honest as I could be.
Yeah. Yeah. And you definitely were. So like you opened the book with like, how did you come up with that? Like, you opened the book with like, that like reeled me in, you know, the first chapter with like, you told like basically the story, like how everything like got started with the sex stuff, the stripping. And so like, is that something that you like someone told you or like, why did you start with that and then go back into the rest of the rest of your life?
Well, it's kind of funny. That's where editing is a good thing. I had actually, well, when I put, to be technical about it, when I put the book proposal together, I needed to put, to send in, I think, 3 sample chapters. And I didn't write those in order. I written the one about my brother, the chapter about my brother. And I think another one that comes later, and then that. And I just had written that sort of on its own. And when I put it together, like the full book, I think I had originally had it, that part somewhere else. And then the publisher was like, no, that goes at the beginning. So I was like, okay. But I had written it just completely on its own. It was kind of floating. And then the decision was made to put it at the beginning. It does. It kind of, somebody said that one of my favorite reviews was it smacks you in the face with a fuck you and dares you to challenge it. It does. Like, I think it starts off, it doesn't start off like once upon a time. It hits you hard, but look, that's life. You know, that's what happened.
So absolutely. Yeah. I remember texting you and said that I just started reading it. And this is going back. I just finished it this morning, actually, but I had started it a while ago. And you said, what did you think? And I think my only response was, wow, like the first chapter, it really, really sucks you in.
Well, it's funny too, because that's the other thing. It's like I was saying earlier, there are times when people will say, especially if it's someone I don't know or someone I knew, but like in a weird, you know, I knew when I was little or they were a teacher of mine or something. And they'll say, I read your book. And my first thought is great. And then I'm like, I start to think about like some of the things that I wrote. And I'm like, oh God, that is a lot of information. I do. Once in a while, I'll go back and look at it if I'm writing something on it or if I'm talking about it. And I do think, oh my God, I can't believe I said that. That's crazy. But there's, you know what, once you put it all out there, it's amazing how freeing it is because it's like, I can't be embarrassed. How am I going to be embarrassed? Look what I wrote about.
Right.
Good luck trying to shame me. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. So let's get into the book a little bit. So the first chapter, you open with you were married to this man for 4 years, right? At the time when he asked you.
He'd asked me a few times to kind of change things, but when it actually happened, you mean when we actually did change things?
Well, no, like the very first time that he asked you, like the...
Oh, yeah. So I think it was about 4 years into it. Into
our yeah. Marriage. Yeah. So Ray, I don't think that Ray has read the book. So 4 years into the marriage, Ray, her husband asked her if she wanted to have sex with one of his friends from work.
Not from work. But you know what? When that happened, it was bad timing. My mother had just died. I just had a baby. I mean, it was just weird timing.
Yeah.
But it was more like pillow talk, right? I think it was like, it wasn't until later when he actually picked the friend and like had it all set.
But it wasn't like this. Knock, knock. Who's there? My buddy.
Yeah, no. But it felt like that later. But yeah, it was just, but you know what? It wasn't my thing. And I'm very open about the fact that I've always been sexual person. It wasn't like our sex life wasn't good, you know, it wasn't any of that, but I've always been kind of more one-on-one kind of thing. And it just wasn't, plus I just battled with a eating disorder my whole life. And so I wasn't thrilled about kind of just like at the time that I was a stripper, but I'm just kind of sharing my body. And again, it was a bad, bad time. I had a lot of stuff going on at that time. It just wasn't, so I said, uh-uh. Plus I honestly, no offense to anyone, but he didn't have any friends that I wanted to sleep with.
So that, I mean, you eventually did though. So
I did. Yeah. Yeah. But that was after, again, multiple traumas that I had been through, and I had just not that long, gotten out of the hospital after being there for months and almost dying and losing a baby and then having another baby and had no family left. And I mean, it was, I had been through tons. And that's when I say all the time, my therapist at the time, and I don't know if she made up the term, but said I was dealing with traumatic overload. And it was just too much, too fast. I couldn't catch my breath between major traumas we're talking about, you know, and I got to the point where I just, my brain just said, you can't handle anymore. And it came up again where he wanted to open up the marriage. And at this point, I think I had lost everyone. You know, I had lost my mother, my brother, my father died, but he was out of the picture anyway. And I felt like the only person I had was my partner. And we had a good marriage at first. And I don't want to say anything negative, but I felt like I wasn't, everyone who had really loved me was gone. And so I felt like, okay, so if this person's saying that I'm sexually desirable and their friends want to be with me, and I felt like I had to prove my worth. Since my brother died when I was young, and ever since, from the minute he died when I was 17, I felt like I didn't deserve to be here. I felt like he should be here instead of me. And I felt like if I was going to be here, I had to earn my space. And I didn't feel like I was doing that. I didn't feel worthy of taking up space and time and resources and everything in this world. And so at this point, when I'd been through so much and felt quite unloved, I felt like, okay, my job now is to be the best mother I could be, because I adored my children and I had the best mother and didn't have her anymore. But then, okay, how am I going to, what can I do for me? It's like crazy. Well, okay, so if I can't be loved, then I can be desired. And I also felt, whether this is, you know, this is my perception of it, if he was willing to share me, then he couldn't love me very much, especially since I had just, he'd almost lost me when I was in the hospital for months. And here he was talking about a friend who really liked me. And I thought, oh, okay, like, you know what? It's such a stupid thing, but it's also something I think a lot of people can relate to, is just wanting to be wanted, you know? And I guess it felt good to be wanted. And I said, yeah. And then, but it changed kind of everything for me. It really affected me in a way that it set things in motion and set me down kind of into a rabbit hole that was tough to get out of.
Yeah, it sure did. So yeah, we don't want to focus too much on that. Because we do want people to buy the book. But the only other question I have about that is, you were doing some online like sex thing in the basement, like in the early internet days. Why not, like, everyone, like you mentioned earlier, like all your kids were at school, you did all this stuff, like you were hiding, like why were you doing it in like the unfinished basement? Like, why not just do it in like a bedroom or something?
I don't know. I don't even know. It was like the worst. That was the worst. That really was a horrible. I know. I mean, there was no, oh God, it was bad. We were trying to save money. And so like, we wouldn't get the video. So I think it was just audio, or was it audio and not video? I can't even remember. Yeah. Why didn't we do it in the bedroom? That's a really good question. I don't even think we talked about that. I don't know. And it was bad. Cause I didn't, oh no, it was, yeah, that was really archaic. Yeah.
So like, what is your relationship with him like now, your ex-husband?
Yeah. Well, I don't like to talk about it too much. It's fine. This isn't his story. So I certainly didn't write it to make anyone look bad at all. You know, I've said clearly, I think he's a great dad. I think, you know, I don't think that he did anything I didn't think he went into anything with like, oh, I want to hurt her. You know, I think it was more, wanted what, you know, people want what they want. And I think they kind of fooled themselves into thinking that, oh, they'll be okay. You know, she'll be fine. We haven't talked about it. I don't know if he's read it. We were together 24 years and there was a lot of good stuff in there, and we have two amazing children, which is a cliche, but it's true.
No, that's good.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah. We want people to read the book, because there's a lot more of that stuff in there in the book. Relationships with, or a relationship with a woman, swinging,
my stepfather,
so
a whole bunch of stuff.
Yeah, well, no, that's what I'm getting into next. Yeah, your stepfather. Yeah, we're not finished here yet. Yeah, let's talk about Eddie, since you mentioned him. So this is like the last thing I have in my notes here is like TV show, movie? But like Eddie, there could be a movie just on him, right?
Isn't it crazy? It's yeah, Eddie. I've tried to find him. I can't find him. But you know, you watch those shows and you hear stories about people who live with criminals, and you think, oh, they're so stupid. How did they not know? But you don't know sometimes. I mean, especially when there are other things going on. There's been a lot going on. I've always had in my life, there's always a lot of things going on. But with Eddie, so Eddie, it was the Satchel Bandit. So my stepfather was a bank robber for, my God. I mean, when they caught him, he was wanted for, I think it was 48 counts of bank robbery over 2 years. And we had no clue. Although looking back, I do feel like a bit of a fool because there were signs, but you still wouldn't think. I joke all the time. I mean, the police were looking for him for 2 years and they had his picture, apparently, in the newspapers. And we were in Montreal and it was in the French newspapers, which I didn't see. But I always say, if I was in a store with him and I saw a wanted picture, you know, with him, I'd probably just go, my God, Eddie, that guy looks just like you. You know, I wouldn't think, oh, it's him, because who, what? That doesn't happen. But yeah, for 2 years, he was so good at it because he would, I was obsessed with food at the time. So he would tell me in detail what he was cooking, because he said he was a caterer. So he was, for 2 years, he was getting up early, and he was every weekend, he was going to cook at a big church breakfast, and he was gone all day. No, he was robbing a bank and coming back. but eventually he got caught in the act. But it was, and then we found out, I mean, the funny thing is, finding out later that, you know, how does the cooking come into it? Well, he had previously been in jail in the States, been in prison for the same thing. And what was his job in prison? Cook. So there you go.
If he just would have had those damn socks.
I know, isn't it so funny? That was it. Yeah, he had his lucky socks, wore them every time. Didn't happen this time. Yeah. Got caught. It's all about the socks. Yeah, it is really, it's scary when somebody can look at you and lie with detail, you know, comfortably for 2 years. It's something. So yeah, I guess it didn't help my trust issues. Let's just say.
Yeah, how old were you at that time?
16. No. He got caught. Well, it was happening when I was like 16, 17, and I think he got caught. I was 18.
Okay. So if he was in the States before that and already in prison in the States, I mean, he was probably doing it for quite a while.
Probably. Yeah. And that's the thing. The police said he didn't even make that much money at the time, but I think it's more of a, they called him like a thrill seeking criminal kind of thing. I think he just did it because it was exciting. You know, he didn't need to, but
right.
You know, some people take up pickleball and some people rob banks.
All right. You mentioned your eating disorders, and I say disorders because in the very beginning you talk about you were just basically killing yourself by not eating. And then by the end of the book, you developed another eating disorder where you were overeating, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I read everything.
Yeah, the doctor though that started the first thing, did you ever like think to write a petition about that? Because I just found out the other day, like from a friend of mine, that like that happened to her too, like when she was a kid, and like the body dysmorphia thing, like her whole life. I'm like, I never knew that. Like,
you, first of all, I mean, there was so much negligence in my family with medical situations. It's Canada. We can't really. Harder to sue. But what I did do was I tried to contact him. I sent him, when I published my body image book, I sent it to him, but never heard back. And when I was visiting again in Montreal, because I'm in Toronto, there was one time I was there to do a speech about it. And I wanted to go and see him, but he wasn't there, because I would have loved to confront him now. And I've heard he's still, I don't know about still, but a few years ago. I mean, this happened, we're going back in the 80s, right? But just a few years ago, I'd gone on to, you know, those Write My Doctor things. Have you ever seen those, like online and people write in? And I actually found him. And just a few years ago, somebody had written in, a girl had said that she was seeing him, and she finally got the nerve up to tell him about her eating disorder. And he said, you just need to find a boyfriend. And I mean, to think, right. So I wanted to think all these years he'd smartened up, but No. So, yeah, that was, and I always say I don't blame him for my eating disorder, but he, you know, he certainly didn't give it to me, but he absolutely made it worse, you know, and that I was really trying to kind of get myself on track, knowing I saw it happening. And then when your doctor tells you you got to lose 20 pounds, or what do you say, 10 pounds to fit into society, when you're not overweight at all, and you just went through a major trauma, it knocked me. Whoa, that was definitely what put me over the edge and set me up for a lifetime of insecurity. And at 17, that's tough, really tough.
Yeah. Wow. And then, yeah. And then later in life, you started overeating then, right? Like that's a whole nother.
Well, it is, you know what, it's all food, and it's all food. I mean, whether I always say like I abused myself with food, and it was either by overeating it, undereating it, you know, with my body, with overtraining when I was bodybuilding, and I wasn't eating and I was overtraining. Like, it's just, it was my way of controlling my life, was to control my body. So with food and exercise, whether it was too much or too little, it was either I was trying to control the one thing I could felt I could control, which was my body, or I was punishing myself, which I did with sex also when I was being promiscuous. It was, I'm such a bad person, how can I like punish myself for it? And it was with food and with sex, both things that I thoroughly enjoy, you know, and learned how to enjoy in a healthy way. Thank goodness. But yeah, it's really a fine line, I find, between the compulsive overeating and anorexia nervosa. It's really just, it was kind of like my drug, you know, and it's awful. And people really underestimate how insidious it is. People really don't get how awful it is, how dangerous it is. And it is, it's an awful, awful, awful thing to have to deal with. And so many people still deal with it, but I'm grateful to have had good recovery for so long, but it's a killer.
Well, it's good that you're doing better with it now.
Hello listeners, and welcome to Quad Pro Quo. Right now, you are probably thinking to yourself, oh great, another movie podcast. Well, dear listener, you would be right. But throw in a couple of marriages, decades-long friendships, and a shared property line, and you have just another movie podcast with a shitload of drama. Inspired by the iconic quid pro quo scene in Silence of the Lambs, each week one of us will pick a movie. It could be a childhood favorite, a classic film noir, an Academy Award winner, or a complete dumpster fire that brings joy to that person's heart. The selector's objective? To get us to love, or at the very least, not hate their pick. Will our marriages, our friendships, and our neighborhood survive? Find out each Thursday on Quad Pro Quo.
You mentioned your dad earlier. You didn't really have a relationship with your dad. And then your brother, you lost your brother when you were young. And there was a point where your dad came to you, and he pretty much wanted to cut. Basically, he was like hoping for all of you guys to say that you didn't want a relationship with him. But your brother was the only one that did want to keep the relationship with him. So when your brother was sick, did they ever reconnect? Did your dad ever call or come to see him at all?
Well, first of all, I think it's you know, you say that, it's, I forget that I was 10 when I had that conversation.
Oh, wow.
You know, when he said, do you want a relationship with me? And I was 10. And wow. You know, my sister was 17. And she said no, because she, you know, we all had different relationships with him. Like, with, he tried to be really cool with her and in a really bad way and offer drugs and just be whatever. And then with me, I was boring. He didn't want to hang out with me. So I said no, because she said no. But yeah, my brother was 15 and he wanted a relationship with his dad. But my father didn't want to hear that, you know. And you know what? I'll tell you something. I had made peace with him. I reconnected with him right before he got sick and passed away. And I have no bitterness towards him. I think that he came from a family where there wasn't love, and he was weak. He wasn't a bad person. He was a weak person. And I've forgiven him for a lot of that. So I really have. But with my brother, no, he didn't connect with him. He kind of, my parents got divorced and he left, and he didn't pay a dime of anything. My mother didn't ask for spousal support, just to help with three kids. You know, she got married at 19, and he didn't want any of that. And he took our phone, he took our car, and you know, it wasn't a great thing. Over the years, so then when my brother got sick, I do remember him. Well, even before that, my mother had forgiven him. My mother had no bitterness either, and so I would see him a little bit here and there, but it was nothing really, nothing right home about me. When Billy got sick, I do remember him being there, but I don't remember him like being there. You know what I mean? Like, I kind of remember him physically kind of being there, but not really. Eddie was there more. You know, I remember Eddie bringing a basketball hoop into his hospital room and things like that. And then I think my father was around here and there. And then over the years, he'd disappear and I'd reconnect because you kind of try, I think, with parents sometimes. Like, I would try. And he would be in for a bit and then leave again. And so there wasn't anything significant with us. But then when my mother died, he didn't contact us. And when I was sick in the hospital and they didn't think I was going to make it, he didn't contact. But I contacted him when I got out of the hospital, and we reconnected for a little bit. And I called him every week, once a week, to check in for 6 months, and then he died. And I'm grateful that I don't carry bitterness. And I think he did the best he could with what he had, and that's okay, you know?
Yeah. I remember what I was going to say earlier. All the things that you've been through, you've never, like, gotten into the drugs or anything, right? Like, you've never... That was one thing that wasn't into the books. When you were stripping, you said like some of the strippers were doing like coke and stuff, and you were too worried about your protein shakes or whatever you were drinking.
I know, that's a crazy thing. That's my eating disorder was way more powerful than the other stuff. So I didn't have a sip of alcohol during the years that I was doing all the craziest stuff. I didn't have a sip of alcohol. I didn't have a drug because I was more concerned with calories in my body, and I've always been afraid of drugs, to be honest. Although, when I got sick and they put me on, you know, OxyContin and methadone and all that stuff, that. But I was always afraid, and so I never did that. But the food kind of took over.
It's really ignorant for me to say, but I remember once saying, "I wish I was an alcoholic instead of having the eating disorder. It just seemed easier." I know it's not. If anyone's listening and they're struggling with drugs, I know it's not. I'm just saying. So I remember that night being out. I was like, I'm married. And I remember saying, oh, it'd be so much easier. And I ordered like 4 tequila shots and I was fine. I just don't have a problem with alcohol. It's just, thank God I don't have an addictive personality where I could be addicted to a lot of things. Cause woof, I don't know where I'd be, but yeah, wasn't my thing. Just wasn't my thing.
Yeah. Like, that's a good thing.
And sex and food were kind of my things, I guess.
Yeah, no, that's a good thing. And it probably helped you also remember a lot of the stories, too. I mean, unfortunately.
But... Oh, that's a good point. That's a good point. Yeah, trauma kind of messes with you. But you're right. I wasn't. That does make sense because I wasn't waking up from a drunken stupor or anything like that. And yeah. It also, I couldn't, if I was doing that, it would have been much harder for me to be there for my kids. Right. Because even though I wasn't sleeping, which was hard enough. I was never under the influence of anything. So I could, when I was with my kids, I was with my kids in every way.
Right. There's a comedian that I like, Joey Diaz, his name is. And he's like, he tells stories, like the wildest stories about the craziest drugs that he's done. And like, I always think he's got to be making this shit up. And then it's like every time that he tells the story, it's exactly the same way. So like, unless he's just been lying about it that long, but then he'll call somebody and be like, "You remember that time we did this?" And they're like, "Oh yeah,
that's what I was going to tell you, Casey." Like, there are stories that I know about myself, but only because it's a secondhand thing that someone else told me. So I think Joey's like that. Somebody else told him the story. He remembers bits and pieces enough to put it all together from what other people tell him about what he did.
Well, I've heard a lot of people talk about, other comedians who talk about Joey and how they'll go see, he has a podcast now, right? And they'll go on his podcast and he's doing drugs and they're like, we can't even get near. Like, I think his system, his body's just like, yeah, whatever. Like, I don't even think he's affected by stuff anymore. Yeah. But his stories are amazing. I agree.
Yeah. Yeah. But it's like, if I try to remember stuff, like, I mean, I've done basically everything but heroin. Like, I don't remember stuff. You know what I mean? Like, I can remember acid trips vividly that I've taken for some odd reason. But like, other than that, like, I could barely tell you what I did this week, you know?
You know, it's funny though, but the closest I came to kind of something like that is when I was in the hospital and I was on a crazy amount of drugs and I was hallucinating. When I came out of that, I remember saying, like, I couldn't differentiate between what had happened
and what I had hallucinated. And I'd have to look at my husband and go, okay, did this happen? Or was that part of my, you know, I knew that when I remember the nurses telling me to run because the doctors are trying to kill me, that was probably a hallucination. But then some other stuff. So that it, yeah, it does. There's definitely some memory stuff. But you know what I found? I found that once you start writing stuff out, like you start remembering one memory leads to another memory leads to another memory. So because I've had people say, how do you remember so much? And had I not written it, I probably wouldn't have remembered so much. But as you do it, your brain kind of unlocks a different part that unlocks a different part. And then it's amazing what you can. And look, sometimes you don't want to remember. I mean, I think sometimes our brains protect us, like, no, you don't want to go there. So we're gonna pretend. Let's just forget that one. I wish some of that. Listen, I get flashbacks sometimes of memories, and I kind of go, "Ooh, okay, you know,
Yeah.
not my best moments."
Yeah. All right, I just have a couple more things. So what is fit versus fiction? You just mentioned that briefly in the book.
So I that Fit versus Fiction was a program that I had started. Didn't plan on it, but it's when I kind of got out of the crazy life and got my act together and went into recovery from my eating disorder. I came out of it and I was healthy and I was in a whole different headspace. But I saw having my kids were young at the time, I really hated the lessons that they were being taught at school about health. It was all about weight loss and it was really creating problems with the kids at school. People. Kids, I would hear the kids in the back seat of my car talking about the food and dieting, and they were like elementary school. And I didn't want other kids to go through what I went through. And so I just went to their school and said, I want to talk to kids about body image and media, marketing stuff, and diet culture. And they let me come in and speak. And it literally just became a thing from there. It was the kids loved talking about it. The stress that they were feeling, the pressure that they felt about how they looked. And they would tell their parents, who then spoke to the schools where their siblings went to, and different schools would have me come in and speak. And then it just became a thing where I called it fit versus fiction, because what is really fit, you know, and what's not really fit. You know, we kind of confuse physical appearance with physical fitness, and it's not the same thing. Then what happened was at the time where, again, we're talking before Facebook, just the beginning of Facebook, maybe. So we didn't have the body positivity, body image things, the groups organized. Nobody was talking about it. And nobody wanted to. It's not glamorous to talk about your eating disorder. It's not glamorous to talk about taking food out of the garbage, or, you know, it's just not, it's not pretty. It's not sexy. People didn't want to talk about it, but I was willing to talk about it. So when I'd see something on TV, a segment that they would do on food or something I didn't think was healthy or the right message, I would call or I would email and they'd say, okay, well, will you talk about it? And so I started going on different TV shows and radio programs talking about the issue with body image and self-esteem and all the stuff that was going on that was really negatively impacting kids. And then the Fit versus Fiction just came out of that. So it was a program that I would bring to schools where I'd speak to kids and teachers and parents about the issue.
Okay. Now, two things out of that. Remind me after I, or just go into it then about the Geraldo thing, you being on the Geraldo thing and how they like kind of pitted you against that other lady. But the first thing is that in the book was crazy to me about like all the shit that you went through, but then like that, and I don't know if they do this. I don't have kids or anything, so I don't know if they do this in the United States or if this is just a Canada thing. But like when they went to the kids and like they hired those, or not hired, but like elected those like the food police, like kids, like it from like pre-K, was it pre-K or kindergarten?
Kindergarten.
Yeah, kindergarten through like whatever grade, like that they were supposed to check the kids' lunches every day to see if the food that their parents were packing them was healthy or not.
Yeah, and it was. I don't even. It was so crazy. It wasn't even a like a Canada-wide thing. I don't even know if it was just my school. Listen, my kids' school. They did not like me very much because I fought this. And I remember, I say in the book, I remember picking my kids up from school and them getting in the car and one of them going, you are not going to be happy. And I'm like, what happened? And yeah, they had an assembly and they decided that they were going to have from kindergarten, they were going to pick certain kids to look in the kids' lunches. And if they had a good lunch, they got this little raffle ticket where they could win something. And then if they had a bad lunch, they didn't get it. And it's like what the kids didn't know what was good and what was bad. And oh, I was livid. And I called the school and then I called
community nurse. I called, got everybody I could call, and it, I got the program taken out. But they were not, it was an, you know what it is? I think a lot of times schools will go, like, they want to look like they're doing something good. But really, you got it. So what happened was, a lot of parents were afraid to speak out, but they knew what I did, and that I was doing this already, speaking at schools. Because, I mean, I would hear from parents who say, my kid's afraid to eat. My kids, and they don't want to be judged. They would go into the bathroom and they would eat their food in the bathroom. I mean, great. So now you're creating a secretive eater, you know, a binge eater. Mm. There were kids who were purging at lunch in the bathroom. I mean, it was such a big thing. I couldn't, it got to the point where it was like, when I went into the program for my own eating disorder, I was like, I never want to think about this again. And then I came out and I couldn't shut up about it because it was like, it was such an issue but it was, and a lot of parents didn't even know what was going on also, you know, and it's really important. I mean, the messages that we get about food early on are so important.
Yeah, I don't think they do that in the States, Casey, because my kid would have already gotten in trouble for going in his bag and pulling his finger out, being like, that's
well, the only thing I've ever heard about anything like that in the United States is I had an ex-girlfriend who had a friend who her daughter took in, I remember, like a peanut butter and jelly sandwich or something one time to school, and they made her like sit like 50 yards away from everyone because like there was one kid in the school that had a peanut allergy.
Well, they do send out that list every year about the allergies, and that's annoying. It's like, okay, so they find out who has the peanut allergy, and if you have peanut butter in your lunch, don't offer them any.
I don't know. I know. As I'm telling you, being Gen X and growing up in the '80s, it just seemed seemed so much easier, wasn't it?
Yeah. None of that shit. Like,
I mean, that's basically.
I don't remember
when we were kids. Oh, you have a peanut butter sandwich. Well, that kid can't eat peanut butter, so don't let him eat your sandwich. Don't give it to him. No matter.
And then you'd offer it to him every day.
Yeah. Now, again, it wasn't really Canada. I don't know what, if it was our school board or what, but it didn't last long. But again, they were not. I was called into the principal's office because they were not happy with me. It's like, it's okay. You don't have to be.
So is that what led you on to the Geraldo show then? Was it that? But that whole.
No. It was in a nutshell, really, this woman from the States had written. Oh, no. She posted a picture of, she was very fit. And she posted a picture with her three little kids. They were like three kids under five or something. And she had a tagline that said, "What's your excuse?" So basically, look how good I look. You know, what's your excuse for not being fit if I have kids or whatever? And it was huge. People loved it. Oh, it's inspiring. And then a lot of people were like, "What the hell is that?" Like, and she also, I saw it and I knew enough. I'd seen her on TV or something where I thought, no, she's eating disordered. Like I could tell by the way she was talking. There was no way she'd be like, oh, I don't work out. I lift my kids in and out of the car. And I'm like, liar, you know, you're lying. And a lot of people had written about it, but I wrote about it. She called herself Fit Mom. And so I wrote for Huffington Post saying why I'm not a fit mom anymore. And I was still fit, but it was comparing when I used to bodybuild and I know how unhealthy it is. And I just sort of said all the things, how my life was healthier when I found balance and not to shame people. My God, you know, I would have been fine if she would have said, hey, these are my challenges and I've overcome them. You can overcome. But it was just mean. Anyway, I get a call from Fox. I mean, I'm so naive. But the Geraldo had a show called Geraldo at Large. And they wanted me to come on because they really agreed with me and they thought it was really important. And when I come on and just talk to Geraldo about body image and all that, sure, right? And yes, it was Fox. But look, what could go wrong? It's just it's a positive topic. So I went in and I'm sitting there next to him. And I swear it may have been not even two minutes before we're going to air, although it was edited, which was worse. And he just leaned over. He goes, okay, she's going to be here via satellite. I'm like, what? So they didn't tell me that they were bringing her in, that we were going to be. And he said to me, don't be afraid to cut her off. They wanted a cat fight. They wanted us to go after each other. And what was funny was, it's not me. I'm not going to do that. But if you watched it, it looked like it was me because the editing, because I remember starting off, he said, oh, this is Marcy. And she's one of Maria's biggest critics. And I was like, no,
you know, I'm sure she's lovely, but I, no, that didn't, they didn't leave that. They just had me just going after her. And I thought, no, I'm Canadian. I'm the nice one. But so I was just, I felt pretty duped. And I do want to say though, years later, she did come out with a thing saying that she did have some food issues, and I felt pretty validated with that. But yeah, that's what happened. I spoke out, and then I was like, yeah, they got me. They got me.
I'm glad he didn't find anything in that vault.
Yeah, exactly. That's right.
He deserved it.
It's funny you say about the niceness of Canadians. I think you might be the third Canadian we've had on, right? George Buza.
George, we might have had more. I know.
Yeah, I don't know. Oh, David Morrell. David Morrell was originally the author of First Blood. But anytime we, like, Ray offered to, I think, hurt someone for David Morrell, and he's like, come on, man, I'm Canadian. I don't want to do that.
Listen, we're not, it's not utopia. We're not perfect, but we're pretty good. I feel pretty, like, you know, we're not armed. That's something.
Marcy, this was great. Ray, what do you have for Marcy?
I just want to point out that I love your Instagram page. I like to watch you dance all over town. It looks like you're having such a good time. Keep making those videos.
Thank you. I always say, when people say, you must be so happy, I'm like, no, the world's a mess. But you got to find the things that make you happy. And for me, if there's music on, I'm going to dance. So dancing down the street and being ridiculous makes me happy. So as long as I can do it, I'll do it.
Yeah, I was like, that was originally when we first booked this, I was like, that was one of my first questions. Like, what's with the dancing? And then I read the book and I was like, she has every right to dance wherever the fuck she wants to.
Well, I say all the time, I've cried enough tears. So when I want to dance, I'm going to dance.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a great book, Marcy. You did a great job. Thank you. Please let everyone know where they can find it, where they can find you, all that good stuff.
So the book, The Good Stripper, Soccer Mom's a Memoir of Lies, Loss, and Lap Dances. It's available on Amazon, and you can get the audio on Audible. I am really every social media platform, Instagram, Facebook, a little TikTok, you know, the huge. And if you read it or you listen to it, reach out to me and let me know what you thought.
Yeah, it's a great book. I highly recommend it. I left you a little review there on Amazon today.
Oh, thank you.
On Audible it was.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. So, yeah, and I will plug, we'll put all the links in the description and all that stuff. So,
perfect. I appreciate this. Really great meeting you guys. So,
you too. Nice meeting you. And, yeah, like Ray said, keep up the, I know you stopped the dancing for a little bit because of everything going on in the world, but yeah, we want that to start up again. So,
okay. I'm going to try.
All right. Thank you so much, Marcy. We appreciate your time.
Thank you. Take care.
Yep, you too.
All right, bye-bye.